I'm feeling a little bit hungover today. Not your typical hangover. It's a debate hangover. Are you sick and tired? Did you take a mental health day today for the third and final? Thank God it's the final debate. Got a great show coming your way on Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. Thanks, as always, for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Almost 11 o'clock in New York City here on a beautiful day. Almost a fall-like day. The last couple days have been great. Summertime. Makes you want to head to the beach, out to the Hamptons. Went out to Montauk last weekend, actually. Nice. Very nice. Haven't been out there in years. Great show coming your way. We're going to be talking about more deplorable, yes, more deplorable actions by professional athletes. And what a surprise. It's an NFL player. What an anomaly. I'm going to talk about some students I spoke with recently who really opened my eyes on a few matters. And there's a new website and a new line of clothing called Schizophrenic New York City. We're going to talk about that. We'll talk about how New Jersey has passed a crucial bill that higher ed must have mental illness professionals available 24 hours a day. All that coming your way. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Give us a call. Tell us what's on your mind. Are you sick of these debates? You must be. I tell you, though, SNL does a pretty good job of characterizing what's been going on, but nothing beats the real thing. Nothing beats the real thing. I mean, you cannot make this stuff up. I don't care what kind of writer you are. And I said to my wife last night, I'd say through 85% of the debate, there was a split screen until the final summation. Each person had a minute to surmise why they should be president, because the split screen just really just depicts how Trump can't even keep a straight face. He tilts his head. He makes that fish mouth look. He blinks. He drinks. He scrubs his nose. He does and blames it on a microphone. It's really hysterical. But then something worse happens. He opens his mouth, and it just really all goes south. So I imagine if you're listening to this network and to this program, you're probably highly likely not a Trump fan. And good for you. Hey, it's a democracy, and I love that we live here, and I embrace that, and everyone has a voice and an inalienable right to vote, and that's very, very cool. But I just can't fathom, as I'm sure you've pondered as well, how somebody without any real political experience, okay, let's just put that aside though, without any really policy issues that can hold water, can even consider running for office. It would be almost like if I considered to run for office. I mean, you know, I know the basics of government, the branches, certainly more than most people, from what I was reading in a recent poll lately, that most people don't even know the three branches of government in the United States, which is deplorable, but another laughing matter. But it's just absurd. And just the name calling and everything. It's just, let's get these 20 days over with. As a matter of fact, I am going to be going on vacation. My wife and I are taking my in-laws, her parents, on a vacation for my father-in-law's birthday. And we're actually going on a cruise ship. First one for me. Never been on a cruise ship. Never really had any desire to. But you know what? You do what you need to do to make other people happy, right? Wink, wink. So I will be in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean somewhere when the results come in. And speaking of results, it's very interesting how Trump has basically stated that he will not support the results of the election and concede if he loses. So, I mean, it just proves, again, another character flaw in this person who's supposed to be a statesman or the position of statesmanship. Anyway, we're going to move on from there because, you know, it's just the mudslinging. But at one point, though, I was halfway through the day yesterday, so I had 3 o'clock, and I was driving back from a talk. And I was like, I'm getting a little tired. Let me pull over and get some tea. And I'm like, oh, that's right. The debate is on tonight. And I got really psyched. I'm like, oh, you know, I texted my wife. I got to get some popcorn. You know, this is great because, you know, you just really can't make this up. Just how their mannerisms and her looks. And Hillary, you know what? I like her for who she is. And obviously she's got an abundant more experience as a statesman with world leaders. Yes, does she has some, you know, blemishes like most politicians, and I'm not giving her a cop-out or anybody else, because it should be a position held to a highest level, esteemed position of ethics and morals, and I believe no one should be exonerated for doing things wrong or less things wrong than the other politician, so then we grant them the highest office in the nation. Anyway, so there we are. So I'll be floating somewhere. When the cocktails are flowing, you know, I'll find out who won and who lost and either throw myself overboard or, you know, go for a dinghy to another country, or we'll figure it out. As Donald did say, I'll keep you in suspense. So I was at a school the other day, speaking to actually a bunch of different grades. One of them was 8th, 9th, and 10th grade, and the others were 11th and 12th. At one point, I think there was about 800 kids I was speaking to. And it's really kind of neat. As a speaker, you can take certain points where you're talking, and, you know, it warrants certain pauses to underscore and give an exclamation point to a point or an issue or a question, because it gives people reason to think about, you know, what your statement is, and take pause in the content and maybe do a little self-reflection. So sometimes, and in this particular case, I took a little bit longer because I was really, really keen on their attention. You know, I mean, for, I'd say 90, 95% of the time, I have, you know, majority of the audience paying attention, but they are kids after all. As a matter of fact, I pride myself, excuse me, when I have, you know, third, fourth, fifth graders, you know, on the edge of their seats, which is great. So we're talking high school kids. And so I pause at a point where I usually pause. It's in the middle of a story where I'm in a triathlon, my first triathlon. I realized moments before the gun goes off, I can't see the swim course. So what was I to do? So a few minutes into the story, I realize at the halfway point of the swim, when I think the hardest part is behind me, I realize the sun is completely in my eyes when I'm turning around at the halfway point. And I'm like, oh my God, are you kidding me? When I just thought it was going to get easier, it's getting harder. But then there's a point in the story where I kind of bask in the moment, because there are all these water bubbles coming up and these sunbursts are coming through the water, and it's really, really tranquil. So I kind of hang out there for a moment describing this before I come back and say, but I wasn't even stoned, because I talk about drugs and alcohol as well. But there's that point where I pause, and then I snuck a peek at the audience because I'm kind of bent over, kind of contorted, showing how I'm swimming, etc. And I took a peek, and it was just kind of remarkable how many faces and kind of some of the mouths that were open that I could see that were near the stage. It just kind of like really made me confident in my decision to, you know, speak to schools and the choice I made 5 years ago or so, and certainly speaking to the students afterwards. But at that moment, you know, like something bad happens to you and you can replay that moment, it seems like a really long period of time. Well, this was the opposite. This is like a very good moment that I was able to play again and again, because I was able to visually just kind of inaudibly take note of it. So it's kind of cool. If you ever, just kind of a note to self, like if you're ever in a good situation, like I remember my wedding. I remember I wanted to, said to myself and my wife, I said, listen, we should take a moment, even if it's 30 seconds or 60 seconds, just not to talk to anybody, go in a corner and just like on a macro sense, just take it all in. Not even talk to each other, just look at the whole room, the chemistry, the family, the food, the music, everything, and just kind of get lost in it. So you can kind of capture that moment and put it in your archive, in your Pentium upstairs in your brain, and able to tap into that whenever you like. Kind of cool. So the talk went really, really well. And the nicest part about the talk was a couple components. Before the talk actually started, I saw a student in a wheelchair, and he was the first one in the room. So what I did was I went back and introduced myself. Hey, my name's Mark. He introduced himself, and he had a paraprofessional with him. A paraprofessional is somebody who basically, it's kind of like an aide. They assist the student. Sometimes they help them out with their work, et cetera. But sometimes an aide just kind of helps transport and or get the student from point A to point B. So I had the real pleasure of finding out, you know, his name and what makes him tick, what he likes to do, et cetera. And I didn't want to ask him kind of what his struggles were before the talk, because, you know, I wanted to kind of keep it positive. I don't want to bring him down before I get up on stage. So after the talk, or actually at the end of my talk where I opened the floor for Q&A, he asked a question about 5 minutes into other questions, and he raised his hand. And I thought to myself, wow, this looks like it could be the student in the chair I spoke with prior to the talk. And it certainly was. And his question was, he said, Mark, how different did you feel when you were in school because of your visual impairment? So when he asked that question, it kind of, first of all, it said to me, it spoke volumes to me because it said to me that he wants to know how different I felt because he feels different. So I thought that was so incredible that he had, first of all, at that age, to raise your hand and ask a question in front of your peers is pretty daunting. I mean, you know, even your coworker, sometimes when you're at a meeting, you raise your hand, you're like, well, I'm not really sure about our 401k, whatever the question may be, can be a little nerve-wracking because you're being judged to some degree. So here you are, a kid who's sophomore in high school or junior in high school. He's in a wheelchair, raises a hand, and I'm like, wow, you go for it, man. This is great. What gusto you have. So he asked the question, and then I said to him, I did feel different. And the stories that I told you kind of depicted how I dealt with my difference by really getting into woodworking, riding my bike a lot, and trying to be like the really affable, gregarious guy that everybody would like to, you know, be around and embrace, which really was my personality anyway, but I just kind of took it to a different degree. So, but as I'm answering this question, I know he's asking it about himself. And then the other point I wanted to bring about him asking this question is that how brave he is to ask this question in front of his peers, because his peers are now, obviously, I'd say, who knows, a good portion of them are interpreting the question he's asking to me about himself. So I think on two levels, this boy is incredibly brave. And sometimes, you know, we don't give kids, teenagers, young teenagers on the lower end, enough credit because, first of all, a lot of them are very, very smart and much more sensitive and in touch with their feelings than we realize. Again, this could be a generalization, but I think sometimes, you know, out of sake of time, possibly, and or preconceived notions, that we sometimes don't give kids the credit they deserve because we feel like, well, maybe they're just not that experienced in life. And that can be true, but it depends on parenting. I mean, it's all about parenting. You know, when our kids come home, how was your day? You know, sit down, what was your day about? Best point, low point, et cetera, you know? And we share things like, you know, this weekend, we got two soccer games that I coach, my two kids, and then afterwards we're heading to the beach because there's a Jersey-wide beach cleanup this weekend. So, you know, we're parenting by example, taking to the kids to the shore, and they're going to clean up the beach. You know, how much debris is there? Nah, probably not too much, especially by the time we get there. We're going to be getting there a little bit later. But the point is, we're showing that community effort is pivotal. So the same thing for kids. I think we need to, you know, obviously expand and expose them to different dialogue. And it goes back to this student asking a very, very good question. So the talk went really, really well. And the person who hired me asked me to... I said to him, listen, I don't have to leave for another hour to go to another talk in Trenton, New Jersey. I'd be happy to speak with your special education students because I speak to them as well because my story of overcoming adversity really resonates with them very well. So she said, that'd be great. That'd be great. That's really kind of you. I'm like, listen, it's no charge. You know, this is what I love to do, et cetera. You know, I'll give you an hour of my time. So she brought back to her office two students. And one of them was the one in the wheelchair who asked the question. Really nice boy. So I said to him, listen, I have to tell you, you are really brave. He's like, why? Why? I'm like, for asking that question. Number one, as I said to you a few moments ago, just raising your hand and asking a question is daunting. And I told him the reasons why, as I explained to you, why I thought he was brave. And the look on his face just was so fulfilling for me because it gave him a lot of positivity and a lot of confidence because you could tell that he was looking for something to grasp when he asked that question. And I think he got more than he realized in return because it made him feel very, very gratified. And of course, he's still in a wheelchair. He's still going to have a lot of hurdles in life, and we talked about those. But for that particular day, and maybe for a week, hopefully, and more importantly, that the kids around him will learn to respect him more, which is great. I mean, that's all about, you know, especially in October, especially like last week, I wasn't able to be here because there are so many different types of walks. Sorry, walks. I do walks as well. Host the walks. I hosted one last weekend and an obstacle course for people with all abilities out in Calverton, Long Island. It was called Happy Fest, which was a great event. Anyway, but there are all kinds of weeks in October. Pride Week, Week of Respect, Red Ribbon Week, et cetera. We're going to get to those in a few minutes. But it's very, very fascinating to find out what makes these kids tick. Kids with disabilities, kids who don't have apparent disabilities, more labeled as invisible disabilities. I mean, I tell people, young and old, doesn't matter. We all have disabilities. You know, it's what we do with them that define us, whether they're obvious, real, or perceived. That's the reality of it. You know, so the other young man who came into the guidance counselor's office apparently suffers from a lot of anxiety. So my heart really went out for this kid because, I mean, having anxiety, which we're reading about more and more nowadays because of the stressors that are placed on kids, how many teams they're on, how much homework they're saddled with every night, you name it, clubs, organizations, you know, it's just absurd. So, but this kid, I think, just has more of a general anxiety, and I'm not minimizing it because any anxiety in at all is just kind of sucks. Yeah, there's no way around it. It just sucks. So here's this bashful kid, you know, husky, no doubt, and it looks like if I just sneezed, he would, you know, fall apart. He just seems very brittle, and certainly I just wanted to not go in and ask him a lot of questions, and so I just kind of let him know about my story, because I thought that would be a good way. If I exposed myself to him, it would be a good way to kind of introduction, a nice little entree into the conversation more so than like, so, you know, why do you have anxiety? What makes you more anxious than not, et cetera? So this way I kind of put myself out there, expose myself, he'll feel a little bit more comfortable in kind of saying, well, you know, the overall school environment, you know, is not welcoming to me, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I did. I said, hey, listen, you know, when I had like my worst anxiety, you know, going to work or thinking about X, Y, or Z used to make me feel really panicked. And that's how I started having panic attacks, et cetera. So I thought that was a good way. And we spoke for like 10, 15 minutes. And then I said to him, so let me ask you, is it just kind of walking into the building that makes you anxious? Or is it the notion of a certain class or a teacher or homework? So we kind of pinned down certain aspects of it. And it's interesting, again, I have to state, again, for the record, not that I said this morning, but, you know, I'm not a psychologist or social worker. There are no initials after my name, but I say to people, I'm an expert in me. Like, we all should be expert in ourselves, right? I mean, hey, who knows you better than you? Donald Trump. That's right. Trump knows everything about everybody, and he's the smartest guy in the world. Of course, I was wrong. I'm remiss. But anyway, in reality, nobody knows you better than you. I was telling this student that, listen, you really have to get good at knowing yourself. And so here's what we can possibly work on, buddy. I said to him, listen, so if walking into school gives you anxiety, let's have a goal. So let's plan on tomorrow, if it's okay with the guidance counselor, which she said, of course it would be. Let's just try to walk into the front door, walk through the front door and get to the guidance counselor's office. And then when you get to this office, be like, well, that wasn't so bad. All right, maybe I can tackle my locker right now and go grab some books, you know, break it down piece by piece, you know, task by task and see how it works for you. And we kind of went through that day and, you know, made some jokes here and there. And I said to him, and before you know it, in a week, two or three, you're going to be like, I can't believe I was freaking out about walking into school. Now I can possibly, you know, look forward to seeing, you know, Susie or Johnny or whatever, or maybe just being confident enough just to go about your day. I said, you don't have to worry about, you know, making friends. If you make friends or have friends, that's great. And those friends obviously should appreciate you for who you are and knowing that, you know, you have some struggles with being around a lot of other students, et cetera. But know that this is just a temporary setback. So to the kid, you know, you got to realize that, you know, there's going to be a lot of hurdles in life and a lot of, you know, difficult things, and gave him all the examples of, you know, the things I was working on, you know, I was going through freaking out with my panic and anxiety attacks. But the reality is, you know, this is something that's doable. You got a lot of support systems here. You got your guidance counselors. You got your parents. You know, you could actually speak to somebody outside the school system if that makes you a little bit more comfortable, whatever the case may be. And I think that's just a great way to kind of support a kid. And I felt like a little bit of the world was lifted off his shoulders, because you could just tell when people are really tense. Especially, I mean, a kid's nervous. He doesn't know about me or know much about me. As a matter of fact, he wouldn't even attend the talk, the two talks that I gave, because he can't be in a room full of that many students. So here he is, you know, a freshman, and, you know, he's got a few, you know, potholes ahead of him in the road that he's on. But I'm confident, you know, the kid that walked out of the office 15, 20 minutes later, you know, seemed a little bit more positive. And, you know, we can't really underestimate the value of, you know, talking to people and just realizing the impact that we can have on people. And we're going to have more right after this. So don't you dare look back, just keep your eyes on me. I said you're holding back. She said shut up and dance with me. This woman is my destiny. She said ooh, shut up and dance with me. We were victims of the night, the chemical, physical kryptonite. Help us to the base and fade. Could it be another professional athlete's in the limelight? No! Of course. Well, the Giants aren't doing that much right this season. I mean, they actually won a football game the other day, which is unprecedented. Well, not as bad as the Giants. 1-5. Really? Really? Wow. Anyway, Josh Brown, the latest one in the news, the kicker. The kickers are now being the violent ones. I thought the kickers were the timid ones. My God. Ah, this is Inside on the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Thanks so much for sharing your Thursday with me and hearing about the New York Giants. Josh Brown, a kicker. Wife Molly turned over documents recently to the Washington police that actually happened last year. So apparently, I guess they have a marriage where they send emails back and forth to each other. Josh, not a good decision to make if you're pummeling your wife. You don't admit things. Well, I'm glad you did, but you're kind of a even more of a jackass besides hitting your wife, domestic abuse. You're supposed to keep it to the pigskin, my man. Anyway, so I'm glad that he self-incriminated himself by sending all these emails. He actually signed a contract of change. Oh, isn't that nice, Josh? Really, really proud of you, man. But I guess the 40 times that you had some domestic abuse against your wife, Molly, your lovely wife, Molly, I guess that contract wasn't ironclad, huh? Not as ironclad as your fist. So apparently, these were released on Wednesday, yesterday. And this is 5 weeks after Brown was back after a one-game domestic violence suspension. Because, you know, the NFL does not take any domestic violence issues lightly. No, not Roger Goodell. He's on everything. So, you know, I just don't understand. I'd like to see, and I thought about this on the way in, and I didn't have time to research this, but I'd like to see if there's a study done on domestic violence in terms of careers, socioeconomic status. I'm sure we could probably, derive that it probably is lower socioeconomic class that there is more presence of domestic violence. So now, bring it to the pro spectrum, pro athletes spectrum. These people, for the majority, have been in bubbles all their lives, and everything is about their physical prowess, their ability to be the best they can be, or strive to be the best they can be. And they've been told all their life how good they are, how great they're going to become, and you know their life is going to be set for them, work hard, et cetera, et cetera. So for the most part, again, this is a generalization, they've been put on a pedestal. But I still can't comprehend the fact that with all that being true, you know, we've seen all the films and read the books and documentaries and everything the media's put out in terms of players feeling entitled, et cetera. But what gives somebody the right to hit another person just because they're frustrated? Because I guess violence is so indoctrinated in everything that they do. You would think they'd actually be able to just take out their aggressions on the field or the court or the rink or you name it. But it's just, I really would like to find out. I mean, I was actually starting to write down all the names of NFL players and athletes in general in the last 3, 4, 5 years. It's up to almost 50 names. 50 names. Isn't that crazy? I was actually going to run off a few names. I'm like, well, why bother? It goes up to about 50 of people who are arrested, accused, and or imprisoned, have done time for this. I just don't understand. And of course, you know, which is, I'm glad there are some repercussions in place by the NFL, suspensions, fines. I think there should be a whole penalty system. But of course, the NFL is kind to detract from that by doing good in October by breaking out the pink. That's right. Let's just suit up our players in pink and let all the women in the United States think that the NFL is a good place and that they respect women. Yeah, that's right. We'll put them up in pink and give them some pink shoes and some pink socks, and maybe some of the coaches wore pink jerseys. I'm sure there's a lot of ridiculing about that because of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. But Roger Goodell, I'm sorry, that's not going to do it. Because, first of all, that's only for a few weeks, and wearing pink is not going to change the image of the NFL. Because the bottom line is we have a serious, serious issue nationally. I've got lots of issues nationally. But in terms of violence against women and spouses and significant others, it's really deplorable. So the NFL needs to change its policy. They've been rapidly changing a lot of things. Obviously, they should have been in place years ago. But there should be a no-tolerance, zero-tolerance policy of anyone who has any charges brought against them and are found guilty. I mean, they should just lose their position. Their contract should be null and void. Maybe the team has to pay out the contract to a charity. Maybe that's a concept that teams should wrap around their heads and contemplate that. Players should have to be part of mandatory education about drugs and alcohol. I know they have to attend something about, you know, proper behavior, ethics, and etiquette, which you, by the sights and actions of the players, you would think they didn't have to attend these classes, but maybe it needs to be ramped so much so that they can understand, all right, maybe my antics off the field are a little bit ridiculous. I know I'm a star quarterback or a running back or tight end or wide receiver, and I made 3 touchdowns in my game today, but that doesn't give me the right to go out to a bar and grope women, grab them, you know, unnecessarily and without permission. It's just kind of unfathomable. I can't see how people could do it. I mean, okay, take out the star status. If I went to a club, seeing that I was single, how could I ever think that I have the right to touch another person, whether of the opposite sex or whoever I'm attracted to or whatever? It's against law. I can't do it. You know, it's a violent act. So I think that really needs to be considered. You know, for example, when I speak to schools about anti-bullying and a lot of the things, mental illness, drugs and alcohol, I think it should be mandatory because it all comes from parents. It all comes from, you know, what you're exposed to, that maybe every September, every other year, that the parents have to attend a mandatory, whatever, 30, 45 minute meeting about anti-bullying, drugs and alcohol, and mental health. 15 minutes on a subject. Or their kid cannot attend school that year until that parent comes in. This could be done online, maybe in the beginning, but how good would that be? I mean, it would not have a bad impact on her students or their child or children, because exposing parents to what is available or what potential harm is available out there, you know, is certainly worth. What parent would be like, all right, my kid, it's not worth 30 or 45 minutes of my time. That's absurd. So maybe the NFL needs to embrace something of the same nature. Maybe every 30 days, someone has to go for a review, or you have to watch a 15-minute mandatory a video on this, and they also have to do it with Skype or a video so they can actually see the player watching and listening to the actual audio simultaneously. So the players or coaches, the coaches or management can go in and say, okay, Mark Farrell, watch this entire video, sat in front of the screen. You can see the presence of a player in front of the screen the whole time. So just food for thought because, you know, when I read about this morning, I just couldn't believe yet another athlete, yet again. And actually there was the NBA Knicks star, I forget his name. He was just found not guilty, I think yesterday, of gang rape, I mean, I can't believe I have to even spew these words. More after this.
Girl, I'm bringing everything I offer. If it's not enough, then tell me what you wanna. Right. I'm supposed to have your love, be an honor. Just know I bring the heat like a sauna. I promise I will never bring a drama. Maybe we can fix this, never be a runner.
So what extremes would you go to miss a test? In high school, college, maybe higher ed? I mean, did you, like, yeah, obviously you got a doctor's note, maybe forged by someone else or your mom, or Dia Mysticata. Like, what extents did you go to? I don't remember going to any crazy extents, but you got to check this out. There was a high school kid yesterday that jumped out of a second-story window to avoid taking the PSATs. Right on. Yeah. Now, I think this person should get, you know, a medal of most creative and most dangerous way to avoid taking a test. by the way, we always love your input at 888-874-4888, or email me, Mark, at markfarrellmotivation.com, and tell me your most creative way that you got out of taking a test or almost got out of taking a test. My mother was the high school nurse in where I went to school. And that's actually when I tell students, like, that was my most adverse condition, having my mother in school for 4 years. Oh, this is Mrs. Farrell's son. Oh, there goes Mrs. Farrell's son. Do you believe Mrs. Farrell's son did that? Oh, wow. Whoa. Did your mother know you do that? Oh, man, it was bad. Anyway, so, yeah. So my mom, I know, wrote a lot of passes for students because my mom was really well-liked. She was a good person. And if you didn't abuse it, and you went to her, there are a lot of girl students who went to her and said, listen, Mrs. Farrell, I'm not feeling that well. It's that time of month. Okay, no problem. Sit down. Do you have a test today? Yes. Well, all right. If you didn't abuse it, she'd give you a little pass and, you know, go in the other room, sit down, lay down, whatever. But so I know there was a lot of it back then. I'm certainly sure times have changed a little bit. But this student yesterday who jumped out of the window survived. She didn't get, you know, maimed or anything. She did get a broken ankle. But I mean, hey, getting a broken ankle not to take the PSATs or SATs, I think it's worth it. And the only reason why I say this, I'm kidding, is because when I took my PSATs and SATs, listen to this. So visually impaired, right? I can't wear glasses or contact lenses. So here I am all through my 4 years of high school struggling to read the chalkboard, which is near impossible. Just like I try to read this phone number, and I always screw it up. You think I'd know it by heart here. Anyway, so I was always behind. Academically, I just never tested where I should be, should have been. But I knew I, you know, had the smarts, but I just couldn't deliver because I was always behind. So now in terms of preparation for PSATs and SATs, are you kidding me? I was nowhere even near prepared. Nowhere even near. Oh, my Lord. So to make matters even worse, when I actually took the PSATs and SATs, imagine this. Okay, imagine like your favorite newspaper. What's a newspaper? Okay, imagine your parents' thing that they used to like to do, read the newspaper. Oh, you remember that now. Okay. Like the New York Times, before it got smaller, like 3 inches smaller in its vertical size, that was close to being the size of my SATs. I kid you not, no embellishment whatsoever. So it was a large print SAT provided from the New Jersey Commission for the Blind and Visually Impaired. So they brought this behemoth test to my guidance counselor's office. I can't even tell you how many trees were lost due to my cause. And so I'm allowed to take this test in my guidance counselor's office back then, a few decades ago, and untimed. So I'm thinking like, oh, cool. This is great. Large print, untimed, cool. I think there were like four or five questions on each page. That's how big it was. And I didn't have to fill out the little, what's it called? The circles, whatever that sheet's called. Just slipped my mind. But you know what I mean. So I was like in seventh heaven. So for like question seven, I could just write D, all the above, or C. I didn't have to fill in a little Scantron. That's what it is, Scantron sheets. They were the bane of my existence. That and card catalogs. Card catalogs. I could do a show on how they used to freak me out alone because, as a matter of fact, I was in real sidebar here. I was in Philadelphia a couple weeks ago, and there was this great bar, restaurant bar, and on a roof, they had a roof bar, and it was all about a former library, et cetera. And throughout this whole restaurant bar, they'd have little things that were a reminder of the former home of being a school, a library, et cetera. So they actually had a card catalog. And I'm like, oh, my God. I, like, freaked out. But the first thing I wanted to do is smell the card. Because remember they used to smell like glue? I used to love the smell of it. So I used to have a love-hate relationship with the card catalog in libraries because I could never – it was really hard for me to read the not Dewey Decimal. Dewey Decimal? No. What was the card catalog number it's called? Dewey Decimal? Anyway. But the reference numbers for the books on the shelves. Forget it, man. Anyway, so here I am. I had this bar, a few drinks in me, and I start looking at this thing going, oh, my God, I'm freaking out. This is crazy. So anyway, back to the SAT story. It was kind of crazy that I'm taking this test, and I took a long time. And I remember the guidance counselor would be like, hey, Mark, you done? No. Still taking them. Okay. Hey, Mark, just checking in on you. You getting close to finish? No, not done. It took me a long time. And the outcome wasn't too positive. I don't even think to this day I've shared with my wife. Maybe I did once. My actual score. It was pretty bad. And hence the reason why I was admitted into actually every college I applied to, I got in. But on a probationary status. So that was another thing I speak to students about and still do and was really haunted by because, like, here's another reason why I'm different. I'm in school and don't do well academically, not doing well, you know, sports-wise, and, you know, not the most popular kid because I, you know, couldn't fit in that well, even though I tried. And it was, like, you know, accepted on a certain, you know, level, certainly for who I was and what I was able to do and et cetera. But here I was, another example of being different, accepted by William Patterson University on a probationary status. And this is where the real trouble began, ladies and gentlemen, because here I am allowed to live on campus with permitted to take only three classes. So when you're on campus, you have to take a minimum, I think, four or five as a full-time student. I'm taking three classes to prove in the first semester I am smart enough, I am hardworking enough, I'm resilient enough to prove to the board that I can overcome adversity and I can study, put my nose in the books. And I did. But in the meantime, that's when I discovered a thing called cocaine and frats and frat parties and sororities. And that's when the beginning of the end started for me, if that makes any sense, which is a whole nother topic, which I have shared with you a bit in the past, which I will share more with you in the future. But that's kind of how it began for me. But it's interesting how when I thought of this girl jumping out of a second story window to avoid taking the PSATs and her SATs, I'm like, wow, I can kind of totally relate on a certain level. It's 38 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock here in New York City. My name is Mark Prowl. The show's Insight. We got more right after this. It's my game, and you better come to play. I used to hold my freak back, now I'm letting...
PRN.FM, your station for progressive viewpoints on politics, economics, health, the environment, and a whole lot more. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Did you know Gaia has aligned with the Galactic Center? Our energies are rising from 3 to 5D. a transformation that integrates a new heart awareness and embodied ascension. I'm Catherine Davis. Please join me on Heart of Mind Radio for the New Millennium for conversations, insights, healing, and spirituality with love, peace, and compassion on Friday mornings, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and anytime. Listen or download on the PRN.FM archives.
We're back. It's Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Mark and Mark Farrell, motivation.com. Demi Lovato right there, who is very big. I mean, she's has been in the industry for, I don't know, big for about 4 or 5 years right now. And she actually indicated recently that she doesn't like the industry. Well, I mean, a lot of people who are in the music industry, entertainment industry, actually don't really love it. But I think they actually stay in it because of, number one, their ego couldn't allow them to leave the industry. And number two, a thing called dinero. Yeah, they love the money. But hey, kudos to Demi Lovato for saying, you know what, this industry is not for me, especially, you know, being a woman. We're reading more and more certainly about how up-and-coming singers are really mistreated by producers, labels, etc. And the good thing is that more women are speaking out about this. And I really applaud them because how are we going to change and remedy the situation if we don't know about it, first and foremost? And Demi Lovato, good for you. If music is certainly something that is close and dear to your heart, but the actual industry itself is not something that you embrace because of, you know, I don't know what the true reasons are. Maybe it's because of the touring schedule. Maybe it's the demands of the label. You need to have, you know, 5 singles out and every 8 months. I mean, that's a lot of pressure unless you're buying songs or maybe you're committed to only writing your own songs. I'm sure there's a, you know, a boatload of reasons why somebody could not like this industry. I'm sure there's a lot. So check this out. She may be into, is it wrestling that she wants to go into, Zach? I think she wants to go into wrestling. I'm not sure. But apparently she works at a gym, Demi Lovato, multiple hours a day. And I guess there's a lot of wrestlers, female wrestlers that work out, or MMA, something like that, with her. And they're like, she would be a kick-ass fighter. So I think she's segueing from one violent, vile industry to another. Anyway, Demi Lovato, good luck from all of us here at PRN. So in October, as I mentioned to you before, there's a lot of special weeks that are set aside at schools for students to really take a time out and hear speakers, read about things, and hear things that are important, like Red Ribbon Week, Week of Respect, Pride Week. And now there's a new week being introduced. It's actually been around for a little bit, but it doesn't get much recognition. So Red Ribbon Week is about alcohol and drugs, because obviously we want to make sure that we know that students know all the dangers involved with using drugs and alcohol. And I actually tell students that I started smoking pot when I was in 6th grade. And that was the gateway drug to me. Now, of course, you can't get hooked on THA, pot. But that was the drug that said, all right, well, you know what? This is fine. This doesn't do much in terms of addiction and or being a problematic lifestyle event. Certainly going to school, you know, right outside of school and then walking into school, sauntering in stoned was not conducive for trying to read the chalkboard. Thinking clearly and intelligently and being able to problem solve. But that aside, it wasn't an addictive drug, certainly. But that was it. So then I got to high school, started drinking, really didn't really dig beer that much, but certainly drank enough just to try to fit in because everyone else was trying to drink and this nasty beer back then. I don't even know what we drank. It wasn't even Bud. It was something. Was it Pabst? Whatever we can get our hands on. Didn't even have to be cold. Ugh. Bad times, but good times. Anyway, so that's when I got into college, started doing lots of cocaine, etc., and completely came close to ending my life by doing extremely idiotic antics. And I share all these things that I thought I was doing correctly to get myself a little bit more popularity, be the big man on campus, life of the party, etc. But how is all the wrong decision making? Because I thought that the void I had inside of me would be replaced by all the things I mentioned, by being beloved on campus, et cetera, et cetera. So when you set aside weeks like this at school, it's Red Ribbon Week, it gives speakers, myself, and educators a great opportunity to say to kids, listen, here's the reality. If you use and if you abuse, here are the possible consequences. Especially when I mention the fact that, you know, once, I mean, there's so many different stories. One in particular, I remember being pulled over with my friend. I was probably about 22, 23 years of age. Now, I did not have a driver's license due to my visual impairment, which I still have. But I did not have a driver's license because they didn't come out with the glasses that I wear now. They're like telescopic devices. So here I am, three sheets to the wind. My buddy who's driving is just as drunk as I am or more. We get pulled over by a cop. And the reason why we get pulled over by a cop, because when we're coming out of this bar, my friend said to me, now, if we go to the right, this is a four-lane divided highway with a median. If we go to the right, Mark, I think there's probably a DUI check. So let's not go that way. So he turns off his lights. And I think this is the coolest, funniest thing in the world. He goes, let's do this. He turns off his lights, hits the gas of the truck. We go flying across the two lanes of the highway, which there was no traffic coming. And then we go through the median. It has like a little gully. And then we jump back on the highway. He puts on his lights and continues to go the opposite way on a two-lane highway, the correct way. But he said to me when we got back on the highway, did you see that? I said, no, what was it? He goes, it was a flash. What that flash was were the headlights of our truck bouncing off the reflective tape of the police car that we almost T-boned in the median with his lights off. Can you imagine that? Almost T-boning a cop going across the highway, completely drunk out of your mind, and then jumping back on a highway, throwing your lights on and driving down the road like nothing happened. Now, I laugh at this because I can safely say the outcome, as you're going to learn, was pretty benign. But it could have ended in so many different, very, very poor and dangerous and horrific ways. So, yes, the cop comes after us, chases us, pulls us over. And now the policeman, he was actually very nice, who probably could have been enraged at us because we could have killed the guy. Was like, you know, license registration, we go through all that and ask my friend, you know, have you been drinking? I forget what he said because I was polluted as well. But my friend was able to actually save his own rear end because he pulled a name out of his hat, which was the police chief of that town or somebody. Anyway, he got away with it. So the policeman looked at me, he shines the light at me across the cab of the truck and says, are you able to drive? And I looked at him and said, absolutely, officer. Now, come on. All right, let's count the reasons why I shouldn't have driven. Number one, I was completely drunk. Number two, I'm visually impaired. And number three, I don't have a license because of my visual impairment. So three reasons why I was insane to get behind a wheel. So if right in front of an officer of the law, I switched places with my friend, drive down the road, and we switched like 5 minutes later after we're out of the cop's view. But could you imagine that? Oh, my God. So these are some of the stories I tell to kids. And, of course, there's a story of, it's a long story, but basically riding on top of an elevator. Because why ride in an elevator the conventional way where everyone else rides? So let's pop out the elevator hatch and ride upside down and hang from the I-beam atop of this five-story building. I mean, there's so many examples of how I could have killed myself, killed others in the process of entertaining them, in which I thought I was entertaining them. Countless examples of me driving other people's cars, inebriated, driving off the road, slamming into, a curb. I remember actually sitting, this is in college, I remember sitting in the Exxon station around the college campus, sitting there with my head in my hands going like, oh my God, how am I going to pay for this? What am I going to do? I mean, my best friend was cool about it. She was like, Mark, no problem. You go get the car fixed. It's no problem. But I was completely mortified. My self-esteem was non-existent. I remember lifting up my head because someone said, Mark, in the Exxon station. I look up. It was one of my professors. And I'm like, oh, my God. He goes, hey, what are you doing here? Because he knew I was visually impaired. He knew I didn't drive. I'm like, he was really an affable, grounded guy. I told him the truth. I told him the whole story. You know what he said to me? Do you need any money? I was like, wow, this guy, he's really cool. He's really cool. I thanked him for his gracious offer. But I didn't need money, and And I'll tell you why another day, because that's another story that I'm not proud of, but a story that's very, very good, a teachable story, because I was actually acquiring money in a very illegal way. Yeah, I got a lot of different lives that I lived, and stealing money was one of them. Out of the register of a place I had access to. Anyway, so when I'm speaking during Red Ribbon Week and Week of Respect is all about celebrating differences for who you are. One of the things I mentioned is that, you know, when I met my father-in-law for the first time, he looked at me and said, "Wow, you're pretty tall. How tall are you?" And I looked at him, my future father-in-law, who wears a turban, and I said, "With or without my turban?" Yes, because my wife is Indian. Her parents are from India, arranged marriage. And that's one of the reasons why my marriage is different, because it's an interracial marriage. And it's great. I wouldn't have, you know, wanted it any other way, because I met a person who is incredibly loving, loves me for who I am. She cannot believe the stories I have told her in the past of what I've done and who I was. But anyway, and I love her for who she is. She's an incredibly compassionate, smart, capable woman, mother who's just warm and everything under the sun. Couldn't imagine being married to anybody else. And Pride Week, whether you're LGBT or Q. So there are all these different weeks. And I want to bring this up to you for another reason, because there's also a week, a very important week in schools across the nation called Invisible Disability Week. I talk about having an invisible disability because my visual impairment is not obvious. I don't use a cane or a guide dog, and I don't bump into walls. Well, only after a few cocktails. But it is an invisible disability until I whip out my, hey, easy now. I'm not going to keep a G now until I whip out my pocket magnifier. Yes, I don't know what you were thinking I was going to say. My pocket magnifier helps me to read menus, papers, etc. But my overall, my disability is not that obvious, except for when I walk by people and they think I see them and I don't. And I walk by them, and they're like, "Well, why didn't he just walk by me?" It's because I didn't see you. But there are a lot of reasons why people have invisible disabilities. And so I was reading an article this week by a 14-year-old that said that she really wishes that schools would really give the proper time and observation and recognition to Invisible Disability Week. Because like on a PA in the morning, they say, you know, we embrace Autism Week and mention the students, Mark, John, Mary, whatever, or have their names throughout the building. And so this student was kind of really hurt. And she wants her stance, and she's proud of who she is, and her disability is just one characteristic of who she is. And why shouldn't it be? I mean, my visual impairment is who I am. It's actually made me a more stronger, confident, resilient person overall. You know, your differences do make you stronger. That's my mantra. My difference does make me stronger. And actually got some really great shirts made up recently. So maybe next week I'll give one of them away on the air. And actually the creative concept came from myself. So actually I think maybe in my next lifetime I'll be a graphic designer. Anyway, I digress. So I think it's a great thing, because we all have things that we're struggling with in life. And it's not like we're walking around with a T-shirt that says, "I have schizophrenia." Actually, there is a T-shirt that does exist like that. And we're going to get this woman, Michelle Hammer. I just read about her this morning. She actually created Schizophrenic NYC. And she has schizophrenia. And we're going to get Michelle Hammer in, actually, with Facebook and social media being such a great, timely resource. I actually reached out to her moments before the show started, because we had a cancel guest this morning. Let's see if Michelle would be available, but we're going to hear from her. But there actually is a line of clothing that Michelle Hammer developed that is makes people proud of who they are, especially if you have schizophrenia, which is certainly a very, very common form of mental illness. And me having anxiety and panic attacks, don't have panic attacks anymore, but, you know, general anxiety that ebbs and flows. It's a great way to have people realize that if you're not in a wheelchair, if you don't have a prosthetic device, if you don't have countless things that allow somebody with an invisible disability to be understood for who they are and for having something that isn't obvious, you know? I mean, hey, an invisible disability can be many, many things. Diabetes, autism, you know, depends on your range on the spectrum. But I guess it's a good way to realize, and it's a great way to educate people, because so many different people don't understand how we should react with dealing with people with disabilities. And so that's why having an Invisible Disability Week would be that suitable and much more insightful. All right. I'm looking for my closing music bed. Yeah, it's that time where I got to say hello to Gary Null. So bring in those drums. Or you can keep on 311. I like that. My name is Mark Farrell. Hope you enjoyed Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Here every Thursday at 11 a.m. Speak to you next week. If you like to speak to you at your school or college or corporation, visit me at markfarrellmotivation.com, markfarrellmotivation.com. Many thanks to Jesse and Zach on the controls. Have a great day. Insight on PRN. Gary Knowles next.